guesses with replacement. Say you played roulette and won. Would this increase your chances of winning again? No. In a polya process case, it does. Why is this so mathematically hard to work with? Because the notion of independence, that is, when the next draw does not depend on past outcomes, is violated. Independence is a requirement for working with the known math of probability. What has gone wrong with the development of economics as a science? Answer: there was a bunch of intelligent people who felt compelled to use mathematics just to tell themselves that they were rigorous in their thinking, that theirs was a science. Someone in a great rush decided to introduce mathematical modeling techniques. Culprits: Leon Walras, Gerard Debreu, Paul Samuelson. Without considering the fact that either the class of mathematics they were using was too restrictive for the class of problems they were dealing with, or that perhaps they should be aware that the precision of the language of mathematics could lead people to believe that they had solutions when in fact they had none. Recall Popper and the costs of taking science too seriously. Indeed, the mathematics they dealt with did not work in the real world, possibly because we needed richer classes of processes, and they refused to accept the fact that no mathematics at all was probably better. The so-called complexity theorists came to the rescue. Much excitement was generated by the works of scientists who specialized in nonlinear quantitative methods, the mecca of those being the Santa Fe Institute near Santa Fe, New Mexico. Clearly, these scientists are trying hard and providing us with wonderful solutions in the physical sciences and better models in the social siblings, though nothing satisfactory there yet. And if they ultimately do not succeed, it will simply be because mathematics may be of only secondary help in our real world. Note another advantage of Monte Carlo simulations is that we can get results where mathematics fails us and can be of no help. In freeing us from equations, it frees us from the traps of inferior mathematics. As I said in Chapter 3, mathematics is merely a way of thinking and meditating, little more, in our world of randomness. The Science of Networks. Studies of the dynamics of networks have mushroomed recently. They became popular with Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, in which he shows how some of the behaviors of variables, such as epidemics, spread extremely fast beyond some unspecified critical level, like, say, the use of sneakers by inner-city kids, or the diffusion of religious ideas. Book sales witness a similar effect, exploding once they cross a significant level of word of mouth. Why do some ideologies or religions spread like wildfire, while others become rapidly extinct? How do fads catch fire? How do idea viruses proliferate? Once one exits the conventional models of randomness, the bell curve family of charted randomness, something acute can happen. Why does the internet hub Google get so many hits as compared to that of the National Association of Retired Veteran Chemical Engineers? The more connected a network, the higher the probability of someone hitting it, and the more connected it will be, especially if there is no meaningful limitation on such capacity. Note that it is sometimes foolish to look for precise critical points, as they may be unstable and impossible to know, except, like many things, after the fact. Are these critical points not quite points, but progressions, the so-called Pareto power laws? While it is clear that the world produces clusters, it is also sad that these may be too difficult to predict, outside of physics, for us to take their models seriously. Once again, the important fact is knowing the existence of these non-linearities, not trying to model them. The value of the great Benoit Mandelbrot's work lies in telling us that there is a wild type of randomness of which we will never know much, owing to their unstable properties. Our brain. Our brain is not cut out for non-linearities. People think that if, say, two variables are causally linked, then a steady input in one variable should always yield a result in the other one. Our emotional apparatus is designed for linear causality. For instance, you study every day and learn something in proportion to your studies. If you do not feel that you are going anywhere, your emotions will cause you to become demoralized. But reality rarely gives us the privilege of a satisfying, linear, positive progression. You may study for a year and learn nothing. Then, unless you are disheartened by the empty results and give up, something will come to you in a flash. My partner, Mark Spitznagel, summarizes it as follows. Imagine yourself practicing the piano every day for a long time, barely being able to perform chopsticks. Then suddenly finding yourself capable of playing Rachmaninoff. Owing to this non-linearity, people cannot comprehend the nature of the rare event. This summarizes why there are routes to success that are non-random, but few, very few people have the mental stamina to follow them. Those who go the extra mile are rewarded. In my profession, one may own a security that benefits from lower market prices, but may not react at all until some critical point. Most people give up before the rewards. Buridan's Donkey, or The Good Side of Randomness. Nonlinearity in random outcomes is sometimes used as a tool to break stalemates. Consider the problem of the nonlinear nudge. Imagine a donkey, equally hungry and thirsty, placed at exactly equal distance from sources of food and water. In such a framework, he would die of both thirst and hunger, as he would be unable to decide which one to get to first. Now inject some randomness in the picture by randomly nudging the donkey, causing him to get closer to one source, no matter which, and accordingly away from the other. The impasse would be instantly broken, and our happy donkey will be either in turn well-fed, then well-hydrated, or well-hydrated, then well-fed. The reader no doubt has played a version of Buridan's Donkey by flipping a coin to break some of the minor stalemates in life where one lets randomness help with the decision process. Let Lady Fortuna take the decision and gladly submit. I often use Buridan's Donkey, under its mathematical name, when my computer goes into a freeze between two possibilities. To be technical, these randomizations are frequently done during optimization problems, when one needs to perturbate a function. Note that Buridan's Donkey was named after the 14th century philosopher Jean Buridan. Buridan had an interesting death. He was thrown into the Seine, tied in a bag, and died drowning. This tale was considered an example of sophistry by his contemporaries, who missed the import of randomization. Buridan was clearly ahead of his time. When it rains, it pours. As I am writing these lines, I suddenly realize that the world's bipolarity is hitting me very hard. Either one succeeds wildly by attracting all the cash, or fails to draw a single penny. Likewise with books. Either everyone wants to publish it, or nobody is interested in returning telephone calls. In the latter case, my discipline is to delete the name from my address book. I am also realizing the non-linear effect behind success in anything. It is better to have a handful of enthusiastic advocates than hordes of people who appreciate your work. Better to be loved by a dozen than liked by the hundreds. This applies to the sales of books, the spread of ideas, and success in general, and runs counter to conventional logic. The information age is worsening this effect. This is making me, with my profound and antiquated Mediterranean sense of metrone, measure, extremely uncomfortable, even queasy. Too much success is the enemy. Think of the punishment meted out on the rich and famous. Too much failure is demoralizing. I would like the option of having neither. Chapter 11. Randomness and Our Mind. We are probability blind. On the difficulty of thinking of your vacation as a linear combination of Paris and the Bahamas, Nero Tulip may never ski in the Alps again. Do not ask bureaucrats too many questions. A brain made in Brooklyn. We need Napoleon. Scientists bowing to the King of Sweden. A little more on journalistic pollution. And why you may be dead by now. Paris or the Bahamas? You have two options for your next brief vacation in March. The first is to fly to Paris. The second is to go to the Caribbean. You express indifference between the two options. Your spouse will tip the decision one way or the other. Two distinct and separate images come to you when you think of the possibilities. In the first one, you see yourself standing at the Musée d'Orsay, in front of some Pizarro painting depicting a cloudy sky. The gray, Parisian, wintry sky. You are carrying an umbrella under your arm. In the second image, you are lying on a towel with a stack of books by your favorite authors next to you, Tom Clancy and Ammianus Marcellinus, and an obsequious waiter serving you a banana daiquiri. You know that the two states are mutually exclusive. You can only be in one place at one time. But exhaustive, there is a 100% probability that you will be in one of them. They are equiprobable, with, in your opinion, 50% probability assigned to each. You derive great pleasure thinking about your vacation. It motivates you and makes your daily commute more bearable. But the adequate way to visualize yourself, according to rational behavior, under uncertainty, is 50% in one of the vacation spots, and 50% in the other, what is mathematically called a linear combination of the two states. Can your brain handle that? How desirable would it be to have your feet in the Caribbean waters and your head exposed to the Parisian rain? Our brain can properly handle one and only one state at once, unless you have personality troubles of a deeply pathological nature. Now try to imagine an 85% to 15% combination. Any luck? Consider a bet you make with a colleague for the amount of $1,000, which, in your opinion, is exactly fair. Tomorrow night you will have zero or $2,000 in your pocket, each with a 50% probability. In purely mathematical terms, the fair value of a bet is the linear combination of the states, here called the mathematical expectation, i.e., the probabilities of each payoff multiplied by the dollar values at stake. 50% multiplied by zero, and 50% multiplied by $2,000 equals $1,000. Can you imagine, that is, visualize, not compute mathematically, the value being $1,000? We can conjure up one and only one state at a given time, i.e., either zero or $2,000. Left to our own devices, we are likely to bet in an irrational way, as one of the states would dominate the picture. The fear of ending with nothing, or the excitement of the extra $1,000. Some architectural considerations. Time to reveal Nero's secret. It was a black swan. He was then 35. Although pre-war buildings in New York can have a pleasant front, their architecture seen from the back offers a contrast by being completely bland. The doctor's examination room had a window overlooking the backyard of one such Upper East Side street, and Nero will always remember how bland that backyard was in comparison with the front, even if he were to live another half century. He will always remember the view of the ugly pink backyard from the leaden window panes, and the medical diploma on the wall that he read a dozen times as he was waiting for the doctor to come into the room. Half an eternity, for Nero suspected that something was wrong. The news was then delivered.
I have some, I got the pathology report, it's not as bad as it sounds. It's cancer.
The declaration caused his body to be hit by an electric discharge, running through his back down to his knees. Nero tried to yell, "What?" but no sound came out of his mouth. What scared him was not so much the news as the sight of the doctor. Somehow the news reached his body before his mind. There was too much fear in the doctor's eyes, and Nero immediately suspected that the news was even worse than what he was being told. It was. The night of the diagnosis, at the medical library where he sat, drenched wet from walking for hours in the rain without noticing it, and making a puddle of water around him, he was yelled at by the attendant, but could not concentrate on what she was saying, so she shrugged her shoulders and walked away. Later he read the sentence, 72%, 5-year, actuarially adjusted survival rate. It meant that 72 people out of 100 make it. It takes between 3 and 5 years for the body, without clinical manifestations of the disease, for the patient to be pronounced cured. Closer to 3 at his age. He then felt in his guts quite certain that he was going to make it. Now, the reader might wonder about the mathematical difference between a 28% chance of death and a 72% chance of survival over the next 5 years. Clearly, there is none, but we are not made for mathematics. In Nero's mind, a 28% chance of death meant the image of himself dead and thoughts of the cumbersome details of his funeral. A 72% chance of survival put him in a cheerful mood. His mind was planning the result of a cured Nero skiing in the Alps. At no point during his ordeal did Nero think of himself as 72% alive and 28% dead. Just as Nero cannot think in complicated shades, consumers consider a 75% fat-free hamburger to be different from a 25% fat one. Likewise with statistical significance. Even specialists tend to infer too fast from data in accepting or rejecting things. Recall the dentist whose emotional well-being depends on the recent performance of his portfolio. Why? Because, as we will see, rule-determined behavior does not require nuances. Either you kill your neighbor, or you don't. Indeterminate sentiments, leading, say, to only half his killing, are either useless or downright dangerous when you do things. The emotional apparatus that jolts us into action does not understand such nuances. It is not efficient to understand things. The rest of this chapter will rapidly illustrate some manifestations of such blindness, with a cursory exposition of the research in that area, only what connects to the topics in this book. Beware the philosopher bureaucrat. For a long time, we had the wrong product specifications when we thought of ourselves. We humans have been under the belief that we were endowed with a beautiful machine for thinking and understanding things. However, among the factory specifications for us is the lack of awareness of the true factory specifications. Why complicate things? The problem with thinking is that it causes you to develop illusions, and thinking may be such a waste of energy. Who needs it? Consider that you are standing in front of a government clerk in a heavily socialist country, where being a bureaucrat is held to be what respectable people do for a living. You are there to get your papers stamped by him so you can export some of their lovely chocolate candies to the New Jersey area, where you think the local population would have a great taste for them. What do you think his function is? Do you think for a minute that he cares about the general economic theory behind the transaction? His job is just to verify that you have the 12 or so signatures from the right departments, true or false. Then stamp your papers and let you go. General considerations of economic growth or balance of trade are none of his interests. In fact, you are lucky that he doesn't spend any time meditating about these things. Consider how long the procedure would take if he had to solve balance of trade equations. He just has a rule book, and over a career spanning 40 to 45 years, he will just stamp documents, be mildly rude, and go home to drink non-pasteurized beer and watch soccer games. If you gave him Paul Krugman's book on international economics, he would either sell it in the black market or give it to his nephew. Accordingly, Rules have their value. We just follow